The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Jory Slodke from the North Carolina Reading Service, previously known as Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next half hour, I will be reading to you from part two of the special two-part July-August 2019 issue of Discover Magazine. We continue the cover story with Everything Worth Knowing About Plate Tectonics, Our Planet's Big, Slow Square Dance. Earth is action-packed. Even if there were zero life on our planet, the place would be full of birth and death, marriage, breakup, and even a little dirty dancing. That's all thanks to the lithosphere, a solid layer of crust and part of the upper mantle that's broken into more than a dozen slabs, or plates, of varying sizes. These pieces, divided between older continental crust and younger oceanic crust, ride atop the gooey asthenosphere, a semi-liquid layer of magma and partly melted rock. Most of us may think of Earth's cracked and deepening crust only when we hear of a catastrophic event caused by it, such as an earthquake or a volcanic eruption. But the puzzle pieces of the lithosphere are always in motion, slamming against one another, grinding past, or getting shoved under another slab. More than a mere geological mosh pit, the plates play a key role in climate and evolution. Types of plates. Continental. Crust that's older and thicker, made of lighter weight rock. Oceanic. Younger and thinner, oceanic crust is made of relatively heavier rock. Types of boundaries. Nearly all tectonic action occurs at plate boundaries. Smaller plates may get worn away completely over time, but the centers, or credons, of larger continental plates remain stable. They include the oldest rocks on the planet. Convergent. Where plates smash together, resulting in deformation or destruction of one or more plate edges. When one plate sinks below another, forcing it back down to Melty Town, it's called subduction. This usually involves a heavier oceanic plate being shoved below a lighter continental plate. Examples, the Izubanan Mariana subduction zone, where the Pacific plate is being pushed below the Philippine plate, creating the deepest oceanic trenches in the world, and the Himalayan mountain range, where the Eurasian and Indian continental plates collide, crumpling up. Divergent, where plates pull apart, stretching and often splitting open the crust. This allows magma to seep up. The magma cools, creating new crust. Examples are the Mid-Atlantic Ridge and the East African Rift. Transform, where plates slide past each other horizontally, also called fracture zones, because the stress typically causes splintering into numerous faults or fractures. Examples include the San Andreas Fault. Plate boundary zones, where multiple plates meet in complex, often poorly understood areas of activity that don't fall neatly into one of the other categories. These zones involve larger plates and one or more microplates that may be both squished and stretched between them. Other activity, hot spots. These areas of volcanic activity often exist thousands of miles from the nearest plate boundary. Below the solid lithosphere, thermal plumes in the semi-liquid asthenosphere send out heat energy so intense that it melts the plate above it, allowing magma to seep up through the crust and sometimes reach the surface. For decades, geologists thought that the plumes' positions were fixed, and that as the plates above them continue to move, they create arcs of volcanoes. However, newer research hints that the plumes themselves may also be able to move. As the world turns. The theory of plate tectonics took shape in the 1960s after more precise seafloor maps and seismic activity monitoring revealed signs of our planet's shifting shell. But the ideas built upon those of early 20th century German scientist Alfred Lothar Wegener, who proposed the theory of continental drift. The large landmasses we know today were once joined together in a supercontinent. Although first to describe the idea scientifically, Wegener was not the first to think it. late 16th century mapmaker Abraham Ortelius theorized that the Americas, Africa, and Europe had been torn asunder by catastrophic geological events. Researchers now believe continental plates have come together more than once in the deep past. While the very definition of a supercontinent remains under debate, researchers agree that many of these monster landmasses were large enough to affect global climate by shifting ocean and air currents. These climatic changes, along with the rising of mountains and other geological events driven by plate tectonics, created new ecological systems that encouraged species to spread and diversify. Valbara, the first supercontinent? When, formed as early as 3.6 million years ago, broke up as late as 2.1 to 2.7 billion years ago. What went where? Uncertain. Remaining pieces of it are found today in the Pilbara Craton of Western Australia and Capval Craton of Southern Africa. What's so super about it? Want to start a fight among geologists? Say Valbara is the oldest supercontinent. The truth is, most of the crust from Earth's early days has been subducted, eroded, or deformed beyond recognition. So reconstructions of the shape, location, and time frame of the first supercontinent, however you define it, remain theoretical and hotly contested. It's not yet possible to determine how much continental crust existed this far back in the geological record, or whether large pieces of it were connected. Some researchers consider Kenor, which may have formed around 2.7 billion years ago, as the first supercontinent. Others argue for the earliest mass merging of crust around 2 billion years ago, but can't agree on whether to call it Columbia or Nuna. Rodinia, the empty world. When, formed around 1 billion years ago, broke up around 750 million years ago. What went where? The landmass was likely centered around the North American plate's craton, which may have been smashed against what is now East Antarctica and Southern Africa. What's so super about it? While Rodinia was not the first supercontinent, it's the earliest one that everyone seems to agree existed. Just don't ask what it looked like. Most of what's known about the supercontinent comes from fragmentary pieces of its origins, the edges of individual continental plates that crunched up, forming mountains during massive collisions. We know little of its overall shape beyond these crumple zones, though researchers believe it covered about 18% of Earth's surface area. By comparison, our planet's modern landmasses cover about 29%. It was a lonely place, however. Complex terrestrial organisms did not yet exist. Gondwana, long-lived but only somewhat super. When, formed at least 550 million years ago, broke up around 180 million years ago. What went where? Centered around Antarctica, it included most of today's southern hemisphere landmasses. What's so super about it? While not all geologists consider Gondwana a true supercontinent, they do agree that it was around a lot longer than Pangaea, which formed when Gondwana joined Laurasia, another semi-supercontinent. The longevity of Gondwana and its timing gave it a starring role in the evolution of life on our planet. It formed around the Cambrian explosion, when the fossil record suggests a rapid increase in biodiversity, and then kept itself together as plants and animals emerged from the seas and onto its shores. By the time Gondwana began to bust up, dinosaurs and other iconic animal groups had used it as a superhighway to spread across much of the southern hemisphere. Pangaea, a supercontinent. When, formed as early as 335 million years ago, began breaking up around 180 million years ago. What went where? Most, but not all, continental plates joined together in a rough C shape, centered around the equator. What's so super about it? Sometimes spelled Pangaea, this mighty mashup was first proposed by German continental drift enthusiast Wegener in the early 20th century. He originally called it Urcontinent, but an anglicized version of his other term for it, Pangaea, was what stuck. Although Wegener was wrong about some of the details, putting Pangaea on the map, so to speak, it was an important landmark on the road to plate tectonic theory. Researchers believe that when this largest of supercontinents splintered into smaller pieces, it completely remade the global climate by forcing massive shifts in ocean currents. A 2017 Nature Geoscience study found the breakup released enough stored carbon dioxide to cause additional climate chaos. The next big thing, when about 100 million years from now? What's going where? Likely in the Northern Hemisphere, joining the North American and Eurasian plates, and possibly Australia, around the North Pole. What will be so super about it? While models remain highly theoretical, projections suggest continental plates will bump together in the next in the Northern Hemisphere. Get a move on. It's unclear why our planet's plates can't stay put, or when they started moving. After Earth formed about 4.6 billion years ago, its surface was a hot mess of magma for a long time. Isotopic analysis of some of the oldest known rocks suggests that continental crust may have started forming as early as 4.4 billion years ago, but the details and timing of the process are unknown. Some researchers believe that when the magma finally cooled enough to form a crust, it was a single, contiguous shell. But the mantle beneath, still hundreds of degrees hotter than it is today, may have melted and fractured the fragile crust into pieces, or plates. What set the plates in motion is still debated, but most researchers think that subduction, when one plate overrides another, explains why they remain in motion. The immense force of the cooler, denser plate being pushed down into the mantle creates tremendous energy, which then circulates in a convective flow, pushing up hotter, less dense magma that breaks through the surface along divergent boundaries. How to date a creep. A host of satellites, plus additional ground monitoring networks, precisely track current plate movement speeds. To learn how fast these slabs of creeping crust moved in the past, researchers have a few tools. Make a match. Rocks of the same age and composition, especially if fossils from the same ecosystem are present, likely came from one formation. If pieces of that formation are found on different plates, researchers can measure the distance between them and, using their age, calculate the speed of the split. Follow the stripes. Earth's polarity switches back and forth over time. As magma cools into rock, magnetite grains dispersed within and aligned with the magnetic field become fixed. This records Earth polarity at the time the rock was formed. Oceanic crust, made of basaltic rock and rich in magnetite, is created at divergent plate boundaries where the mantle is constantly coughing up new magma. As the magma rises, cools, and gets pushed aside by newer magma, the magnetite within it preserves a record of Earth's fickle magnetic field. Seen on a seafloor map that shows this record, the periods of reversed and normal polarity appear as stripes. This magnetic striping can reveal how fast the plate boundary expanded during a particular period of polarity, providing a broader sense of the speed of plate movement at that time. Everything worth knowing about monkeys getting into their business. Forget Planet of the Apes. Earth has long been the planet of the monkeys. With over 330 species, monkeys are a diverse group of primates, split into two major lineages: Old World monkeys of Africa and Asia, and New World monkeys of South and Central America. Apes, including gorillas, chimpanzees, and humans, are merely an offshoot of the Old World branch. Some 15 million years ago, apes flourished as a group, but they've dwindled to a handful of species, a near-evolutionary dead end of animals, barely managing to scrape it together, while the monkeys clearly have things figured out, says Duke University primate evolution expert Matthew Bortz. Size is one way to distinguish between hulking apes and more diminutive monkeys. Male gorillas can weigh over 400 pounds, but monkeys max out at the 80-pound mandrel. Monkeys also have tails, which apes lost through evolution. I've often thought that was the very saddest part of human evolution, says primatologist Dorothy Fragese. It would be wonderful to have a tail. You're so much more three-dimensional in your movements. Some New World species evolved prehensile tails, capable of grasping and dangling from trees. Tails aside, humans and monkeys share many other traits, including big brains, color vision, and dexterous hands, suggesting these adaptations were present in our common ancestor. Despite our shared roots, people are the greatest threat to monkeys. According to a 2017 Science Advances paper, nearly half of monkey species are nearing extinction because of deforestation and other unsustainable human activities. Now seems the worst time ever to be a monkey, says Bortz. Monkey in the middle of a raft. Researchers think New World monkeys descended from a population of Old World animals that accidentally rafted to South America 36 million to 43 million years ago, trapped on a mass of vegetation that washed off the coast of Africa, that washed off the African coast. More like floating islands, vegetation mats as big as baseball infields have occasionally been spotted by sailors on the high seas. During this period, the continents were closer, but still separated by more than 600 miles of ocean. Yet provided enough plant material for chow, rain for drinking water, and optimal winds, it's estimated some unintentional mariner monkeys could have crossed the ancient Atlantic in a couple of weeks. You imagine them being a little stressed out about the situation, says Borths. Love life takes a variety of forms. Titi monkeys, comprising over 30 species in South America, are mostly monogamous. Partners stick close together, often nuzzling and entwining tails, and become distressed when separated, indicated by calls, agitated movements, and stress hormone levels. While both parents live for years with their offspring, infant care is primarily dad's job. At the other extreme, mandrill monkeys of Western Africa live in hordes of several hundred individuals. Competition for mates is fierce, and mostly won by the biggest and brightest. Male snouts, genitals, and rumps are radiant hues of red, blue, and purple. Researchers have shown that coloration is related to testosterone levels and dominance. And while these top-ranking males sire more than 70% of offspring, other males sneak clandestine copulations. Beyond procreation, some monkeys engage in sexual acts for pleasure and to strengthen social bonds. At least 40 species exhibit homosexual behaviors, such as mounting and genital fondling between same-sex individuals, which can cause orgasm. Monkeys mainly stick to trees in the tropics, but not Japanese macaques. Also known as snow monkeys, the species endures below zero temperatures by growing thick winter coats and huddling together. One population in central Japan's Jigokudani Monkey Park hang out in 104-degree hot springs. The bathing, first observed in the 1960s, was associated with reduced levels of stress hormones triggered by a cold, according to a 2018 primate study. Some wild monkeys use tools. In Thailand, long-tailed macaques crack open shellfish with stones. On the other side of the globe, in the Brazilian Amazon, palm nuts are smashed hammer and anvil style by capuchins, clever monkeys boasting the largest brain-to-body size ratio of any primate besides humans. Regardless of species, the tool-making behavior is learned. Young monkeys spend years mastering the technique, and not all troops partake. Everything worth knowing about pulsars, lighthouses of the cosmos. The universe is full of weird objects, but pulsars take the prize as the strangest things scientists can study directly. The shriveled remains of once mighty stars, they're around a dozen miles across, have approximately the mass of a sun and can spin hundreds of times per second. They're also made of a poorly understood particle soup, for which researchers don't have the recipe. Here's what we do know. Pulsars are a type of neutron star, the dense core left over after a supernova, a stellar explosion. Astronomers can see pulsars only because electromagnetic radiation, especially radio waves, streams from their magnetic poles. As the pulsars spin, these streams point once per go around at Earth. They sweep over our planet like transient lighthouse beams, and telescopes pick up each one as a pulse. The first pulsar. As part of her doctoral work in radio astronomy, Jocelyn Bell Burnell built a radio telescope by hand, pounding posts, stringing wire, attaching metal. Once it was ready, she was in charge of using it to survey the sky for what astronomers call scintillating sources, the radio equivalent of twinkling lights, in a search for special galaxies far, far away. But on November 28, 1967, she discovered something unexpected, a recurring source of radio waves that appeared and disappeared like cosmic clockwork. At first, she called it Scruff. Then she and her advisor jokingly named it LGM-1 for Little Green Men. Today, we call it a pulsar. Magnetic personalities. So, how do these telltale pulses get started? Pulsars have hugely powerful magnetic fields, some of them a trillion times stronger than Earth's. When magnetic fields spin, they generate electric fields. A pulsar's spinning fields then whip up a current of particles, electrons and positrons, pulled from the star's surface. That current travels along the pulsar's magnetic field lines, spewing radiation from the magnetic poles. It's analogous to what produces the aurora on Earth, says Slavko Bogdanov, a pulsar astronomer at Columbia University. But this is a much more extreme version. Nicer neutron stars. Astronomers are currently arguing, nicely, about what might be deep inside neutron stars and pulsars. They don't actually know, because the pressures and temperatures inside these objects are among the most extreme of any in the universe, and they can't be recreated in a lab. But NASA hopes to learn more through its Neutron Star Interior Composition Explorer, or NICER, mission, an X-ray telescope that literally snapped into the International Space Station in 2017. Scientists have already discovered that a pulsar and a white dwarf can orbit each other more tightly than the moon orbits Earth. They're also testing how our descendants might one day use pulsars, like GPS beacons, to navigate the cosmos without satellites. Astronomers still want to figure out how massive and how wide pulsars actually are, so that they can determine the exact density of their interiors, and finally learn what exotic stew must be brewing inside. They'll also watch for starquakes, the stellar equivalent of earthquakes, possibly due to varying rotation rates, and learn how magnetic fields and extreme gravity whip the rotation around, whip the radiation around. Meanwhile, other teams are using super-fast pulsars to search for gravitational waves, the ripples in space-time that result when massive objects accelerate or collide. By watching for pulses that arrive at Earth not quite on schedule, astronomers hope to learn about the weird curves and bends in space-time that can stretch or squeeze these signals, delaying or hastening their travels. Know your pulsars. The youngest is PSR J18460258. About 500 years ago, light from the supernova KES-75 reached Earth, but the dust and dinginess between here and there, an expanse of 19,000 light years, meant human eyes could not see the explosion. The baby pulsar gestating at its center escaped attention until the year 2000. The oldest pulsar is PSR J01081431. The Methuselah of pulsars. This one has been around solo for some 200 million years, and it's still pumping out X-rays. Astronomers wonder, where does it get the energy? The fastest pulsar is PSR J17482446AD. Faster than a kitchen blender, this guy zings around 716 times per second. Despite its above-average mass, it must still be less than 20 miles across, or else it would spin itself apart. The slowest pulsar is PSR J0250+5854. This pulsar moseys around just once every 23.5 seconds. It's so slow that astronomers could actually watch it clap on and clap off, a normally impossible feat. Currently, no one knows how it could turn this languidly and still produce radio waves. Everything worth knowing about flight. Prepare for takeoff. When the Wright brothers took to the skies in 1903, they were relative new latecomers. Insects had already been buzzing around for 325 million years. But in a little over a century, our species has more than made up for its earthbound origins, visiting every planet in the solar system and even penetrating interstellar space. Flight of the Archaeopteryx. 2 years after Charles Darwin published On the Origin of Species, the discovery of a missing link between dinosaurs and birds gave evolutionary theory a fortuitous credibility boost. Found in southern Germany, the 150 million-year-old Archaeopteryx fossil combined reptilian and avian features. For the past century and a half, scientists have debated whether it could fly. It took powerful X-rays to help researchers begin to put together this puzzle. A team of physicists and paleontologists at the European synchrotron radiation facility in France produced a 3D model of the creature's bone structure using a technique called microtomography. The team found adaptations strongly suggested of powerful flight, but the anatomy indicated wing motion must have been weird, more similar to the butterfly stroke of a swimmer than the movement of any modern bird. This rendering shows the most likely flight pattern. Feathers. Like modern bird plumage, the feathers of the Archaeopteryx are asymmetrical, a geometry that can generate aerodynamic lift by pushing air under the wing. Shoulder. The shoulder point of the Archaeopteryx is transitional between those of ancestral dinosaurs and birds. The earlier dino's shoulders pointed downward, letting them manipulate prey with their arms. Bird shoulders point up, allowing them to raise their wings above their backs. The sideways orientation of the Archaeopteryx shoulder allowed flapping but limited the upstroke. Breast. Archaeopteryx lack the modern bird's prominent breastbone, which anchors flight muscles and guides the tendons that facilitate a rapid upstroke. Arm muscles appear to be more broadly distributed in Archaeopteryx, even running along the belly, probably making flying more arduous than it is for modern birds. Tail. Unlike modern birds, Archaeopteryx had vertebrae running through its tail and asymmetrical tail feathers. The purpose of both remains a mystery. Wing. The arm bones of Archaeopteryx are hollow, likely an essential adaptation for flight because it lightens body weight. In addition, many blood vessels are visible, suggesting vigorous movement like flapping. Based on arm bone geometry, the flight of the Archaeopteryx likely resembled the fluttering pheasants more than the soaring of hawks. Insects and the origin of flight. Found in practically every niche on all seven continents, insects are the most successful class of animals on the planet. But it wasn't always like that. Roll back the clock 385 million years and you'll find the first bug in the fossil record. The next insects appear a full 60 million years after, in sudden and extreme abundance. Last year, Stanford University researchers provided an explanation for the population explosion, the evolution of flight. The insects in the second wave were armed with wings, unprecedented appendages that allowed them to escape predators and reach new sources of food high up in trees. It was one of the greatest of all evolutionary breakthroughs, and vertebrates would not catch on for another 90 million years. Wings go way, way back in the fossil record. Insects were flying tens of millions of years before any vertebrates took to the sky. Bird feathers have multiple functions, ranging from flight to insulation, despite sharing the same basic anatomy. A calamus is the base of the Rockies, are the hollow shaft that gives the feather a strong, lightweight, central structure to support the barbs along its edges. And calamus are the base of the Rockies. The calamus attaches to a follicle in the skin. We've run out of time for today's episode of Discover. Be sure to listen next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Jory Slodke, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service, previously known as Triangle Radio Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This broadcast is readily available as a podcast after the broadcast at our website, trianglereadingservice.org. So long until next time. If you have any comment or questions, please call area code 919-832-5138. Again, that's area code 919-832-5138.